Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is, well, I'm not sure what today is. I'm recording this Monday, July 8th, 2013, but we're getting ready to go back on the road, and I doubt that it'll be published until maybe Wednesday or possibly as late as Friday of this week. So you may be hearing this sometime around the 10th or even the 12th of January, of July, sorry. But either way, it's July 2013, and my name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 329. Today, I'm going to kind of follow up a little bit on a podcast that I did on the 5th, which was in regards to, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the 4th of July and patriotism and all that kind of thing. This, if you haven't heard that podcast, it may make more sense to you. I'm actually using the notes that were left over that I didn't get to from that podcast on the 5th. And I considered naming that one part one and this one part two, but then I wasn't sure if I had enough notes for a part two right at that particular moment, so I didn't. So technically, this might be part two of the podcast from July 5th, but I'll try to make this one as freestanding as possible, so you don't necessarily have to have listened to the one on the 5th to follow along on what this one is about. Today, I'm going to talk about justifiable war. Now, Murray Rothbard. And I have to say that I really appreciate Murray's work. He spent his whole life and just did magnificent work for our cause. And, you know, some of the fundamental things that are accepted now within the liberty movement are there because Murray Rothbard discovered them and pushed them forward. He really was, if not the greatest liberty-minded thinker of the 20th century, he was really close in there as one of the top five. So I have nothing but praise for Murray Rothbard and the work that he did. However, he made a statement, and he stood by it. He repeated it several times. He made a statement that America, throughout American history, there were only two just wars. And the quote goes like this, and this is quoting Murray Rothbard word for word. He said, To be specific, the two just wars in American history were the American Revolution and the War for Southern Independence. Now, I'd have to say, as much as I agree with Murray on a plethora of topics, on this, Murray was wrong. He was wrong on both wars, and he was wrong on several levels here. You know, first off, Murray rejects the use of the phrase civil war. And I do too. I don't like to use the phrase civil war in reference to the American War that took place in the 1860s. It's not, in my estimation, it's not a clear definition, a clear description of what actually took place during Lincoln's war. But Murray rejects the use of the phrase civil war and chooses to use the phrase war for Southern independence. And yet Murray accepts the phrase American Revolution. Now, I know this is, a geeky word pickiness, but honestly, words are the most useful method that we have of expressing thoughts to one another. Human beings express thoughts to each other in many ways, through their eyes, through body movements, through all kinds of methods that we use to express our feelings and our thoughts and our intentions to each other. But words are the primary thing that we use to explain to people thoughts and concepts and beliefs and ideas. And if we don't use words accurately, then it's impossible to understand the full meaning of what a person is saying. So when Murray Rothbard accepts the phrase American Revolution in explanation or in description of the war that took place between the colonists living along the eastern seacoast of North America in the mid-1700s and the British government or elements of the British government, if you call that event an American Revolution, then you are completely distorting the event, the cause of the event, the happenings during that time, and the result of the event. You're actually missing the boat on so many levels that you're pushing forward statist ideas that are just wrong. At the very least, they're deceptive and wrong. At the very worst, it's an intentional lie, not on the part of Murray, of course, but on the part of people who would who have a vested interest in making us believe that that activity was actually a revolution. It was not a revolution. A revolution is where one group of people attempt to wrestle control of the government out of the hands of the previous government and into their hands. So in other words, if Washington and Jefferson and Madison and all those guys that were involved at that time, if it was their purpose to overthrow the British government, kick out Parliament, and form their own government, taking over in London and kicking out the king and becoming their own government, if that had been their intent, then it would have been a revolution, but that was not their intent, and it was not in any way, no action by the colonists went in that direction, and that was certainly not the result of the action. So it is not in any way accurate to refer to that war, that time frame, the actions taken during that time frame, as an American Revolution. It simply was not. That's not accurate, and shame on Murray for a man so intelligent, and yet to make a blunder like that. Also, if you're going to reject the use of the phrase Civil War in referencing the American War that took place in the 1860s, if you're going to reject the use of the word Civil War there, then because technically, it's not the best description for a civil war, but a civil war can be a case where one entity sets itself up as a government and attempts to separate itself from an existing government through geographic means. So technically, it's not completely wrong to call what is typically called the American Civil War. It's technically not wrong to call that a civil war. It's more accurate to call it a secession, or it's more accurate to call it a war of independence. But it's technically not completely inaccurate to call it a civil war. On the other hand, it's completely inaccurate to call the American War of Independence a revolution. So for Murray to reject the use of the word civil war in 1860 and then reference the what was essentially a civil war in the 1770s, you see, technically you could call the American War of Independence, you could call that an American Civil War, and you would be somewhat accurate, fairly accurate, a lot more accurate than calling it an American Revolution. But again, this is all, it's all wordsmithing. It's all framing thoughts in a way so that when you say, or framing words in a way, I should have said, framing words in such a way that when you say them, you can form thoughts in the other person's head without necessarily saying something that's not 100% true. You can cause a person to think of something that's not true by using words in a deceptive manner like that. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but essentially that's how brainwashing takes place, or it's one aspect of brainwashing. So first off, Murray's statement I'll read it again. To be specific, the two just wars in American history were the American Revolution and the War for Southern Independence. So his picky use of the word war for Southern, the phrase war for Southern Independence, rather than using Civil War, sort of defeats the genuineness of what he's saying when he turns around and calls the American War of Independence an American Revolution. So that, so he's wrong there. He's wrong in his terminology, he's wrong in his use of words. But then again, the greater concept of what he's saying here is wrong as well. Because if he's saying those two wars were just, the justice took place, or it was an attempt to provide justice, it was an attempt to produce a just war. And that is what he's saying. He's saying that these two wars were just. Well, I would say no. How can a war that exists for the purpose of removing one government and replacing it with another, how can that ever be just? How can it ever be just to take a slave out of the ownership of one master and put that slave into the ownership of another master and then call that just? How does that make any sense on any level? It cannot be just. A war, by its very definition, is a collectivist action by one large group of people killing other people based simply on the fact that they're part of a different group. It's not an individual killing someone for purposes that are acceptable within the zero aggression principle. It's not someone killing someone else for self-defense purposes, or even, you know, technically, no one in the colonies was being physically threatened by the people in Great Britain. The revolution, if you're going to call it that, which again it wasn't, but the War of Independence took place not as a form of self-defense against people that were attacking the colonies. It took place completely because one group of people wanted to throw out the masters that they had and create new masters for themselves, among themselves. So it was literally the throwing away of the burden of one government with the acceptance of the burden of another government. And the wording says that quite clearly in the Declaration of Independence. So by its very wording in the Declaration of Independence, the American War of Independence was not a just war. And you say, well, how do they get out of taxation? How could they get out of the burden of being forced to deal with? You see, the main issues in the War of American Independence are often confused by government schools and government, you know, court historians. We're often told, well, it was about taxation without representation. No, it wasn't. That's just a lie. The situation you had is you had people who either had never had any taxation at all, or had extremely light taxation, almost invisible taxation, and then all of a sudden they start feeling some taxation, a very small amount of taxation. So yes, taxation was part of the issue. The fact that they attempted to bring their argument to the British government and the government ignored them, that was an irritant to them. But we have that today. Every citizen, every time in history, has always had a government over them that wouldn't listen to them. The thought that the government does what we want is purely a myth. So that's not necessarily a justification for war. The real problem in that time frame, though, was that there was one corporation that was authorized by the British government to do business in the colonies. Everything that was either imported into the colonies or exported out of the colonies had to either go through one corporation, or they had to pay a tax to that corporation if they were trying to do it without going through that corporation. So this was the real problem. Every merchant, of course, there was things like the stamp tax, that was an irritant, and there was the housing of soldiers. There was all those grievances that are in the Declaration of Independence. But what really sparked money guys, business people, people like John Hancock and big supporters, early supporters of the War of Independence, what really got them going was the fact that they had to do all of their import-export business through one government-sanctioned monopoly corporation, and that was the East India Company. That was the issue. That was the big issue that drove the war. And you can look at pretty much any war through history, and you're going to find out at some point in time, money is one of the main factors involved. Money and power, two things. I did a whole series on war, and I talked about that. Money and power are the two things that motivate people to go to war. It's never about self-defense. It's unless you're the one getting attacked. But the spark that causes war is always about money and power. So there were elements within the colonies who went to war for money, because they were either tired of being taxed by the British government, and they were tired of this monopoly control of import and export through the East India Company, or they wanted power. That was the two issues that pushed the colonists into war. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about with the East India Company, keep this in mind. You know, the Boston Tea Party was rebel rousers, colonists, who attacked merchant ships, who marched on merchant ships, took the cargo out of the merchant ships, and threw them into Boston Harbor, the cargo being tea. Now, have you ever asked yourself, if you've never thought about this, and I've talked about it a few times, so some of my longer-term listeners already know this, but have you ever thought about in what way is that an act of defiance against a government to take tea out of a private entity's boat and throw it in the harbor? How is that an act against the government? How does that tell the king? How does that send a message to the king? Well, the reason that they did that was because that ship belonged to the East India Company, and they were not allowed to buy tea or anything else from anyone other than the East India Company, and they were not allowed to ship goods out of the colonies with anybody other than the East India Company. So the East India Company enjoyed this monopoly, and everything that either went into or came out of the colonies had to go through that company. You see, that corporation was the problem. It's a marriage of business and government. Back then it was called, or I should say more specifically than today, the system that we're talking about is called mercantilism. Today we recognize it as fascism. It's where the government is either controlled by or completely controls the major corporations. And the major corporations and the government work hand in hand to supply each other with a monopoly within their field. That's what mercantilism was, and that's what fascism is today. It's what fascism was in the 1930s and the 1920s when Mussolini first identified it as such. That's what it is. That's what it always has been. So the American War of Independence was partly to get out from underneath the foot of the British government, but it was also to get out from underneath the foot of the British East India Company, the corporation that had monopoly power over the colonies. So then, could that have been a just war? Is it possible for that to have been a just war? Not in the way that it was done. It's impossible to have a just war because the war requires, like I said, the very definition of a war is opposing armies, collectivism, opposing armies, killing individuals, killing other individuals for no reason whatsoever other than the fact that they're on the other side. You don't have one person in defense and killing an aggressor. You have two large groups of people who are both acting as aggressors, and then the conflict takes place and there's death because of it. So by its definition, war can't be just. Now, if you also look at it in another way, even above and beyond the fact that war assumes collectivism, if you go beyond that, another collectivist way of looking at this is, okay, what were the motives and the goals of the individuals involved? Well, if you're just going to assume, oh, it was taxation without representation, well, you're just assuming this collective thought. It was one thing. They all had the same thing in their mind, and they were all acting as one. Well, that's not true. Human beings don't act that way. And to be specific about it, and I think I mentioned this some in the podcast on the 5th, if you think about a guy like John Adams and his cousin Sam Adams, these are two vastly different individuals. John Adams being an attorney, John Adams wanting mostly to try to do things legally and do things according to British law and British customs, and to a certain extent willing to stay within the system. He was willing to stay within the process, and even stay within the British government as long as he attained what he wanted. On the other hand, you had Sam Adams, which was practically an anarchist. Sam Adams was real close to being an anarchist. He would be, maybe if he were around today, he would be considered an undisciplined, uneducated, maybe even ignorant anarchist, because all he wanted was just, violence, and he wanted his freedom, but he wasn't willing to give other people their freedom. He was, if he existed today, he would be considered a terrorist. So you have this, and what did he want? He wanted to be able to do anything he wanted to do and not have anybody stop him. He wanted no boot over him whatsoever. So in that sense, he was very much of an anarchist. But in the sense that he was willing to kill people to accomplish his goal, even if those people hadn't directly aggressed against him, that meant he was not a disciplined anarchist. He was an ignorant anarchist. So we have this vast contradiction between John Adams being a hardline statist who wanted a strong federal government, he wanted to be in control of that government, and Sam Adams, who was really, you might call him a proto-anarchist. He certainly wouldn't fit in among our movement today, but you could call him a proto-anarchist. So these were two very opposite people. You have the same contrast with Hamilton and Jefferson. Hamilton being a hardline statist, a hardline, Hamilton was inspired by guys like Hobbes and Hume, big government, mercantilism. Hamilton was very much for mercantilism. He had made a fortune through the processes of mercantilism and in big banking, he wanted all those things. Jefferson was just the opposite. Jefferson was inspired by guys like Adam Smith and John Locke. He was a small government. He was a minarchist. He was a small government supporter. He was he fancied himself as a gentleman farmer, and he kind of in his mind, he wanted to see an America full of gentleman farmers and mom-and-pop shopkeepers, and he had this fantasy, like most minarchists have, that's a very unrealistic fantasy of a tiny little government that's always doing good and never harming anybody, and everybody's, free and independent, and we're all just doing our good things, and the government is only here to serve us. That's what Jefferson envisioned, whereas Hamilton, it was deeply connected with the New York bankers and the whole money, the money men of New York, and his entire wealth depended on the mercantilist system. So he depended upon government monopolies and that was the only kind of economic structure that he could imagine that would actually work. So there's this vast difference between Hamilton and Jefferson. You can't think of these people collectively as all wanting the same thing. They simply did not want the same thing. You think about other people, it contrasts somebody like George Washington with somebody like Ethan Allen. Now, here's two accomplished military men of their day, and quite opposite of each other, and didn't even like each other. As a matter of fact, Washington really, close to hated Ethan Allen. And Ethan Allen certainly certainly returned Washington's feelings. Let's put it that way. Washington really considered himself like Hamilton. He considered himself an aristocrat. He wanted a very proper European style military, a very regimented, very disciplined, all marching in a line, wearing proper uniforms, and this is what Washington envisioned for a military. Whereas Ethan Allen preferred to dress in the colors of the forest and hit at night and move quickly and, you know, strike hard and move away. Don't stay, don't get out in the open and involve yourself in a big open battle, in a big open field where men are just standing right in front of each other shooting each other. Ethan Allen thought that that was pretty stupid. Oddly enough, Washington thought that was a great idea. Washington thought, hey, here's what we ought to do. We ought to all wear bright uniforms, march in lines, stand shoulder to shoulder across the field, and fire directly at other guys that are in bright uniforms, marching in straight lines, standing shoulder to shoulder across the field, and we'll just all shoot at each other until somebody is left alive. That was Washington, and that was the method of European war at the time. Whereas Ethan Allen said, you know what? How about this? How about if we run through the woods in the middle of the night, and we slip into your fort while you're sleeping, and we'll slice your throat before you realize that we're even there? How's that for a method of fighting? You see, Ethan Allen didn't respect the proper gentleman's role in war. Ethan Allen saw war in a completely different light than Washington did. Washington saw war as a proper gentleman's way of using the fodder of the troops to accomplish what you want. And Ethan Allen didn't particularly like the idea of wasting human life for no reason. And that's a vast difference between Washington and a guy like Ethan Allen. Ethan Allen was very much a guerrilla fighter. He worked for a volunteer militia, and he saw the military, the only legitimate use of a military is for defensive purposes. But, you know, like I said, Washington desperately wanted to be a great general at the head of a great European-style army. And that's why Washington hired this guy. If you've ever heard of him, he's often called Baron von Steuben. Baron von Steuben, but he wasn't really. That was a fake title that his dad made up as a money scheme. His actual name was Frederick von Steuben, and I'm not even sure if the title von was legitimate or not, but I know that the Baron part of that was a fake title that his dad made up. Now, von Steuben was a con man. I mean, that's really all he was. He was in the Prussian army, but he got kicked out. He got fired. He was never a general. He told people that he had been a general in the Prussian army, and he made up this great and glorious history of how wonderful he had done in the Prussian army. All that's a lie. He was in the Prussian army, but he was kicked out. Now, he left Prussia in desperation, head over heels in debt. And first he went to France. Now, it was a weird time, in a sense, back in that time frame in the 1700s. If you showed up in a foreign country, let's say you were like Steuben's situation, he had all the proper clothes. He spoke the proper language. He was fluent in English, in German, in English, and in French. Well, no, I'm sorry. He wasn't fluent in English. He stumbled quite a bit in English, but he was fluent in German and French. And so so he shows up in France, and he has all the elaborate costumes of a Prussian military officer. He has all the paper titles and all the paperwork that makes it look like that he's actually a gentleman. And he shows up in a fancy carriage, and he knows all the right hand movements, and he knows how to behave at a proper dinner. Well, that was pretty much all it took, and you would convince the aristocrats of France that you were some fancy German or some fancy Prussian officer. And then he used that position to try to get loans in France, because he had so much debt back in Prussia that he was trying to get loans and financing to bail himself out. Well, after a little while in France, his scheme fell through, and he had to flee. And so he fled to Ireland. And I'm not sure if Benjamin Franklin bumped into him in a pub in Ireland, or if von Steuben actually made his way to England. But one way or the other, in one of Franklin's visits over there, Franklin stumbled into von Steuben and believed his whole story, believed him being a famous Prussian general and being a baron and all this kind of stuff. So Franklin wrote up letters of recommendation and sent him to Washington, because he knew the kind of a guy that Washington was looking for. So, sight unseen, with nothing more than Benjamin Franklin's word on the thing, which is, not worth a lot, Washington hires Baron von Steuben because he thought that that von Steuben could, or the fake Baron, I'm using that phrase almost, not even tongue-in-cheek, almost with a little, if you could see my eyes, I squint when I say it. But he hired von Steuben to create for him a proper European army, because that's what, it was just Washington's fantasy. It's what he wanted more than almost anything else. Now, when I get back from this break, I'll stop picking on von Steuben, and we'll get back into what just war is and what just war isn't. Stick with me, I'll be right back. Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting AmagaiMetals.com. That's AmagaiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you. How would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have a helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee. And they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com first. Click the button for HostGator. And thank you for supporting BadQuaker.com. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. All right, now, I wanted to also mention, you know, I was talking about how Washington was obsessed with building a proper European army and being the head, being the general, a great, respected general of a proper European army. Well, during the war itself, and actually in 1780, in August of 1780, Alexander Hamilton wrote a letter to George Washington practically begging him. He says, and this is a quote, "We must have a government with more power." Hamilton was really frustrated with the continental government because they could not provide Hamilton with the unlimited funding that he wanted for war. And specifically what Hamilton wanted, Hamilton was deeply connected with arms dealers, with bankers, with arms dealers within the colonies, and with arms dealers in France. And so Hamilton deeply wanted a strong federal government that could just open up, you know, debt and just get a whole bunch of debt. And he actually thought this was a good idea. This is, you know, if you study Keynesianism and you understand how these people think, he was basically laying out the argument for Keynesianism before Keynes was even born, before any of this stuff, before any of the argument had ever been made about the difference between these styles of economics. So he deeply believed that this is what you needed a strong federal government with banking abilities to take out massive loans so that you could hire the kind of proper army that you needed to hire, and you could finance the military machine and really get a big style government military running. And in order to do that, you need a powerful government. So he wrote letters to Washington begging him to do everything he could to influence to have a more powerful central government. And Washington Washington could be swayed at different times by different people. You could see in the letters, one of the main ways that I've learned about Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and so forth is reading their letters in the National Archives. And if you read them in sequence, not in the way that they've got them in there, it's a little difficult because the format in the National Archives is not easy to get through. But if you can, if you take the time and you bounce from, say, one letter from Hamilton, then go and find the letter that Washington responded to him, and it's really clumsy, but if you take the time to do it, you can see their mind as they go through this process. But either way, you know, so Hamilton was putting pressure constantly on Washington for a large, powerful federal government. Well, people like Jefferson in his communications with Washington was trying to convince Washington, no, that's the last thing we need. The last thing we need is to throw out an overbearing government and then create one of our own. We don't need that. It's just not necessary. And people like Henry Lee were also writing to Washington saying the same thing. And you can see in these letters that Washington's mind floats back and forth between the temptation of having the kind of power that a strong military and a strong central government would bring to him and the desire for freedom. You can just watch Washington oscillate in these letters back and forth. Okay, so when Hamilton wrote that letter, that was 1780, and the winter, let's go 1779 and 1780. That whole time frame was really, really desperate times for the colonial army. They had faced several crushing defeats during that 2-year period. Washington was in retreat almost the entire time frame. Washington, the one thing, you know, if you really examine Washington's war record, the one thing you have to say is that Washington was excellent at retreating. He was very experienced at running away from a fight. He did have a couple of notable victories, but the war record of Washington in general was that he was an excellent retreater. So he spent most of the 1779, 1780 either in retreat or hunkered down trying to live through the worst winter of the war was the winter of 1779, 1780. In addition to that, and this was part of what Hamilton was complaining about, in addition to that, most of the army wasn't getting paid. They were all being promised that the pay was coming, but they didn't get paid. And on rare occasions when they did get paid, they got paid in script that was being inflated so fast that it was worth almost nothing by the time they got it. So the lack of pay was a real big problem. In addition to that, you know, Washington had von Steuben in there, and all these men, they're cold, they're starving, they're constantly retreating, they don't have proper clothing, they don't have proper arms, and they can't go home. They're being pressed into service. This is not a war of their choice. In addition to not being paid, they're not being allowed to leave and just go home. So essentially, even though originally most of them were volunteers, essentially at that point it was a draft. They were pressed into duty. And one of the things that von Steuben brought to Washington was, and Washington was guilty of it before this time as well, but not to the extent that after von Steuben had come along. I'm tearing up his name again. This time I'm not doing it on purpose. But anyway, before he came along, Washington was guilty of this. But after he came along, Washington sort of, it was a justification for Washington to kill his own soldiers as an example. And he did. More frequently than we would be led to believe by government schools and government historians. So Washington himself is guilty of war crimes in the sense of murdering his own men as examples to force them to stay with him when they weren't getting paid, they weren't getting fed properly, they weren't being housed properly, they weren't being clothed properly, and they weren't being given the weapons of war that they needed to do what he was asking them to do. So at this critical moment in 1780, when things really looked bad, Washington's aides, like Hamilton, were begging him to try to use his influence to create a stronger government so that they could get the funding that they wanted. His men are on the verge of revolution against him. His men are on the verge of turning on Washington and turning on the other officers. And right in this key moment, 1871, the very next year, in 1780, right when this is going on, the French arrived and changed the course of the war. With the French showing up and French supplies showing up and French arms showing up and the French Navy showing up to blockade Cornwallis at Yorktown, by 1871, Cornwallis surrendered. And Cornwallis was situated where he couldn't get out because he was blockaded by the Navy on the ocean side. And he was facing Washington's army and Lafayette's army on the ground side. His last hope was Ferguson cutting through Washington's lines from behind and freeing up Cornwallis and allowing him to escape. The problem was Ferguson decided to cut through Appalachia in order to get there to relieve Cornwallis at Yorktown. The problem with that was that Ferguson announced, people warned Ferguson, you can't cut through Appalachia because the hillbillies up there won't let you. And so he made the public statement, he warned the hillbillies. He said, if anybody gets in my way or tries to stop me, we'll burn a path through Appalachia and we'll kill anybody and burn anything that gets in our way. And we'll basically just loot what we want and take what we want, and we're going to cut through and relieve Cornwallis. Well, that's not a good thing to do. It's not good to threaten Appalachian people like that. So when Ferguson started cutting through Appalachia in his way to attack Washington's behind, the people of Appalachia were not really the people who cut off Ferguson. Were not really interested in saving Washington or saving Lafayette, or they could care less about what was happening with Cornwallis. All they knew was a British army is not going to march through Appalachia and burn and take what it wants. That's just not going to happen. So when Ferguson pushed into Appalachia, the Appalachian people surrounded him on King's Mountain and cut him down and buried him right where he stood. Now, you're not going to get that story from government schools either. What they're going to try to tell you is that, oh, the American militia did this and this and this. No, it wasn't. It was not a colonial militia. It was Appalachian people guarding their property. That's all it was. And when they got done killing Ferguson, they went home. They were not soldiers. They had nothing to do with Washington or the War of Independence. They were just Appalachian people. They were hillbillies living their lives, and they weren't going to take an army marching through their land, taking what they wanted and burning property. So anyway, let's get back to Washington here. So we've got Hamilton constantly pushing Washington towards a European nation state based on the mercantilist system, and we've got Washington wanting deeply a European-style proper standing army, powerful, uniformed, and with an unlimited budget. So now I want to introduce into our little story here a guy who was one of Hamilton's closest friends. He was a guy named Henry Knox. Now, Henry Knox was a real peach. Henry Knox was one of Washington's top aides. Later on, once Washington became president, Washington appointed Henry Knox as the Secretary of War, keeping in mind that when Washington was president, there was no war, and yet he appointed Henry Knox as the Secretary of War. But now, what's important about Henry Knox? Well, remember I was talking a second ago about the war that was taking place, and in 1780, how Washington almost faced an armed uprising by his own men because of lack of funding and the horrible conditions of the winter and everything. And then the French arrived to save the day, and then Cornwallis surrenders in 1871. But see, the war kept going. The war was pretty much over when Cornwallis surrendered, but technically the war was still going, and the soldiers were not allowed to go home. So, and they were still not getting paid. So, So in early 1783, early in the year, Knox threatened to use his military to overthrow the Continental Congress. Again, this is during the War of Independence. And he wanted a strong federal government. He was a close friend of Hamilton, an aide, one of Washington's top aides. And his demands were that he wanted a strong federal government with a central head of state. And he wanted Congress to take out a massive loan and give the money to his troops. And like I said, early in 1783, he actually wrote a threat letter to Congress. He threatened them with his own troops. And he told them that if they didn't take out these loans and give the money to his troops, that he was going to march on them. Washington at this point stepped in and called a meeting of his key officers, including Hamilton and Knox. Now, in that meeting, there was an agreement that was made, and there's no actual record of what was discussed in that meeting. All we know is that when Washington's officers went into that meeting, they were on the verge of marching on Congress. And they came out of the meeting, and Washington had them back in control again. Now, again, this was early in 1783. Washington's officers were on the verge of marching their armies against the Continental Congress. In May of that year, Henry Knox and Alexander Hamilton formed a little thing called the Society of the Cincinnati. Have you ever heard of this? The Society of the Cincinnati. More on that in just a second. The War of Independence didn't end until September of that year, September of 1783. The British troops didn't leave New York Harbor until November of that year, and that was because of the delay in communications between Europe, where the peace treaties were signed, and where the troops were located in New York. So as far as the troops, as far as the British troops in New York knew, they didn't know the war was over until November when they left. But the war was actually over in September. So in November, the last of the troops leave New York. And so in every way, the war is over in November. And in December, George Washington accepted the position of president for life of the Society of the Cincinnati. Now, after George Washington died, the second person who was president for life of the Society of the Cincinnati was Alexander Hamilton. Okay, so this was formed. This Society of Cincinnati was formed in May of 1783, right after this meeting of Washington's officers. And then the war's over, and then George Washington accepts the office of president for life of the Society of Cincinnati. The Society of Cincinnati was established by the followers of the cult of George Washington. Faithful officers who wished to instill Washington as emperor for life. Now, I'm not making that up, and that's not some secret. They were very open about this. They in no way tried to hide that was their intent. They talked about it. They published it. It was spoken of in openly in meetings. It was spoken of in many ways out in the public. It was not something that was hidden. It was not something that was super popular among the population. But it was something that the Society of Cincinnati members were saying openly in 1783. Now, to be a member of the Society of the Cincinnati, you had to be one of Washington's officers or one of the French officers who took part in the war. And again, this is 1783. By 1784, there were over 2,000 members, all officers in the war. Essentially, all of them had in one way or another answered to George Washington as commander-in-chief of the war. So now, at this point, I want you to think back about my July 5th podcast. And in that, I mentioned that there were 55 people that attended Hamilton's unauthorized constitutional convention where the Constitution was adopted. 55 people were there. One of them got used an excuse and left early because he didn't want anything to do with the mess that was going on. So that left 54. You know, Washington was there, Hamilton was there, of course, Franklin was there. Of the 54 people who were left, and I said this the other day, 27 were lawyers, 34 were money men of some kind, money lenders, bankers, money speculators, they were money men of some kind. But also 23 of the 54 were members of the Society of the Cincinnati. They were former officers under Washington. In addition to that, in addition to the official 23 members of the Society of the Cincinnati who signed the Constitution, there were additional members of the Society who were there attending as security. They were outside making sure no one came in, and they were inside making sure no one went out. They were muscle. They were the military, and part the military part of that coup that I was talking about. They were the cult of Washington. They were the fist of Washington, and they were the military part of the coup that took over, the coup d'etat that took over the new United States. That's why in the other podcast on the 5th, that's why I said that the Constitutional Convention was a coup d'etat. In every way, it fits the description of a coup d'etat. It was planned during the war in 1783. It was a planned activity. It was a conspiracy. In every way, the proper way to describe this was that it was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy by an organization called the Society of the Cincinnati, and it was a conspiracy specifically set up in order to put Washington into power and to bring in a powerful federal government, with Washington's top military people being in charge of that government. And if you go through and you start looking at who were the governors after the Constitutional Convention took place and the Constitution was adopted, if you look at the head of government, of the United States government, and you look at the heads of the states, and you look at all the influential people, whether we're talking about on the Supreme Court, in the Senate, it was primarily members of the Society of the Cincinnati. I don't have really enough time to really go into the Society of the Cincinnati in great detail, but it was based on this mythical person in the history of Rome, who at a critical time when Rome needed him the most, he left his farm, came in, became, through an act of the Senate, became the complete dictator of Rome, the first and only, you know, at that time, the only dictator of Rome. And he saved Rome from whatever the threat was, an external threat of some kind. And then in an act of showing what a wonderful person he was, when he was all done saving Rome, he went back to his farm and he relinquished his power as emperor. And this is the statist ideal. This is the fantasy of every minarchist, is the idea that these great men can just come out of nowhere and fix everything for us and then let go of the reins of power once they've saved our lives. This is the great man theory taken to a fantasy level that, you know, I mean, it's the goofiest levels of religion that a person can imagine, that somebody would come out of nowhere, have this vast amount of talent specifically for governing, would save the world through their greatness, and then when there they are at the pinnacle with all the power in their hand, and then they're just going to drop the ring and walk away and just say, okay, I'm done now, I saved the day, I'll go back home to the farm. That was what the idea of the Cincinnatus was, and that's what the Society of the Cincinnati held up as the thing that they valued the most. And Washington to them was the epitome of that, and so that's why they pushed to make Washington emperor for life. So then, this is the motivation of the people who committed the War of American Independence. if this is the intention of that many people, and these are the behaviors of that many people, how can we call that a just war? How can we justify the members of one team murdering the members of another team simply because they're wearing a different colored uniform? How can we justify that? Because that's all war is. It's my side is right, your side is wrong. I'm going to kill anyone from your side that I get the opportunity to kill. And as a matter of fact, unfortunately, civilians in almost, well, especially if you look through the history of the 20th century, the number of civilians killed by war far exceeds the number of military. So by example, by its very existence, civilian populations suffer at least as bad, if not far, far, far worse than the military does during an actual war. We saw that in the 20th century. Now, in if you take the War of Independence, the levels of casualties were probably much worse among the military than they were in the civil population. That's probably the case in the so-called Civil War as well. There was horrible casualties in the Civil War, in Lincoln's War. But again, how can you call this a just war? How can you accept the concept that either of these two wars or any war based on this collectivist idea that as long as you're in uniform and as long as you're killing another guy in uniform, whether or not that person is aggressor or aggressing against you is not the issue. The fact that you're on one team and you're killing somebody on another team and that makes it okay. How can war be justified under any circumstances? And I'll go a little further to any Christians that are listening. Do you think Jesus would have sanctioned the murdering of people simply because they were from another country, or they wore a different uniform, or because your general told you to, or your commander told you to? That's the exact opposite of everything Jesus stood for. And as a matter of fact, when the soldiers came to arrest Jesus, what was his response? What was his response when Peter whipped out a sword and attacked one of the Roman soldiers? He rebuked Peter and healed the soldier's ear. You see, war should always be rejected by anyone who claims to be a Christian, because it's the opposite of what Jesus taught. War is collectivism in its most extreme form. It's assuming that you can murder somebody just because they're on the other team, just because they're on the other side, just because they have a different commander than you have, just because their commander said kill you and your commander said kill them, and you obey. That's war. That is the opposite of just. There is no justice. And it cannot be just. And you know, the Bible says, woe unto the man who calls evil good and good evil. War is evil under any and all circumstances. So what could have been done? What could have been done to bring independence to the people living in the colonies? Well, actually, if you think about it, war of independence is a contradiction in terms. Unless you accept the collectivist notion that a group of individuals has the right to own another group of individuals, I mean, that's the result. That's what you're trying to get in your war of independence, is you're switching from one master to another master. You're saying we're taking the slaves away from this master and we're giving the slaves to another master. That's really what you're doing when you're exchanging one government for another government. So the war of independence, the very phrase itself, is a contradiction in terms. You can't have a war of independence. A war is a collectivist act. It's the opposite of independence. So what could have been done? What could the colonists have done? Well, you know, we face the exact same thing today. We face the exact same question. And as right-wing tending people tell us that we have to have a revolution, and as wrong as that is, and as right-wing leaning people who, some of which call themselves libertarian, say that a point has to, a line in the sand, a point has to come where we have to stand up and take up arms and do this and do that. Well, you're walking right into that collectivist trap. And so what can be done about it? Well, that's the purpose of this podcast. That's not just this individual podcast, but that's the purpose of BadQuaker.com, is to show you the mission of liberty. And the mission of liberty is not to act like a collectivist. The mission of liberty is not to just repeat the same stupid mistake that humans have repeated for the last 13,000 years. The mission of liberty is to show the path of peace, the successful path that will lead us to peace and true independence. Folks, thanks for listening again today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.